Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey friends, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Thursday, the 17th of January, 2019. So let's not lose sight of the fact that it's the day of the Lord and it's the year of the Lord. I'm always reminded by little kids who are quick to finish the sentence, "This is the day," and they will say, "The Lord has made," and they will say, "Let us rejoice," and they will say, "And be glad in it." And I'm reminded that as adults, we don't often remember the joy. So I want folks today, no matter what else is going on in life, remember the joy. Or as my friend Mike Cook used to say, don't forget the joy. Like it's, so you could state this positively or negatively. Remember the joy, or don't forget the joy. One way or another, be sure that today you are operating in a spirit of rejoicing always, praying without ceasing, giving thanks to God in every circumstance, not for every circumstance, but in the midst of it. And so I'm mindful of that today, and I just thought that I would make all of us mindful of that today as we seek to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversations of our day. So I'm going to lead off today with a headline out of California. And let me just go ahead and tell you, it's kind of disturbing. We're going to talk about education, specifically public education, and the way in which public education is used to teach worldview or cultivate worldview, and the ways in which public education is being used to teach children, particularly of children who come from religious families, to teach them things that are very much contrary to the worldview being taught at home. So before you protest that, you know, that's California and not where you live, I want you to keep in mind that California often sets the pace for the rest of us. And so it's important to know about what's going on there. So the California Department of Education is about to accept and implement a new framework for curriculum for all of its public schools in the state. So all public schools in the nation's most populous state will be required to teach within this new pre-K to 12 framework. So this is every kid in public school, pre-K through high school. Now, the entire packet is more than 1,000 pages, but you can check it out online. There's lots of stories up about it at this point. EdSource has one, a headline that says, "Parents, educators should scrutinize concepts of gender and sexual identity in the state's health education framework." And so let's take a look. So again, the California Department of Education moving toward the adoption of this proposed health curriculum framework, which I think the best way I can put it, it seeks to radically transform the way that public school students think about gender and sexuality. And the way that you change the way a child thinks is that you completely reframe the conversation about the human body, about its functionality, about men and women, boys and girls, and their relationships. So this written set of goals and objectives comes in light of the state's new LGBT-affirming sex education law, which is called the Healthy Youth Act. And it will guide curriculum development over the next decade. So we're talking here about a generational impact and effect in public education in the state of California. So children of Christian and other conservative-minded parents are going to find a lot of these new health lessons in direct conflict with the values that they're teaching at home. But it's also important to note, you can't opt out. So in California, you can only opt out of something if it is expressly being taught in a sex education class or in an HIV prevention class, and that's not what these courses are. This is the general health education framework and therefore curriculum for pre-K through 12. And so there's no opt-out provision for people whose religious convictions run contrary to what's going to be taught here. So here is a quote from the proposed framework. "Dispelling myths about gender expectations in kindergarten can lay the groundwork for acceptance, inclusiveness, and anti-bullying environment in the school. Gender nonconformity and physical characteristics are often at the root of many forms of bullying." Now, just let's be clear how that started. Dispelling myths about gender expectations. And what they're talking there about there is the clear difference between boys and girls, men and women, what it means to be male and female. And when is this going to start? Well, this is the portion in Chapter 3 of this framework of these guidelines, and it is related to kindergartners. So these myths about gender that even kindergartners must unlearn are about stereotypes related to who plays with what, who wears what, and whose body parts belong to whom. So the framework encourages teachers to read students books like My Princess Boy. It's about a boy who likes pink dresses, and to invite adults who identify as transgender into the class as guest speakers. And when it comes to health lessons about their physical bodies, about their organs, the framework tells teachers to dispel the myth that male and female reproductive organs are different or specific to a gender. So when providing instruction, this is a direct quote, when providing instruction on sexual and reproductive organs, teachers can introduce the concept that gender does not always match the sexual reproductive organs described. For example, teachers might share, quote, here is something a teacher can just read. In the classroom, we may use the term female reproductive organs, but some people who identify as male have these organs too. The actual anatomical name for the organs should then be utilized. Again, this is the kindergarten curriculum. So according to the logic of this new framework, males who have female reproductive organs and females who have male reproductive organs, that's just the new reality. That dispels the myth of gender. So the teacher is supposed to use only the accurate anatomical names for each one of these body parts and organs, which is age inappropriate, as the way many of us would see it, never referring to any of the parts as expressly male or female or distinctly belonging to a boy or a girl. So while these new gender lessons start in kindergarten, they're reinforced at every grade level along the way. The entire proposed K-12 health curriculum framework is available online. It consists of 9 chapters with lots of appendices. It includes 842 mentions of the word sex, sexual, and sexuality, 239 of the word gender, and many of those, in this curriculum that goes all the way down to kindergarten. The word abstinence, that does appear twice in 1,000 pages. So although Christian parents would find many objections within the framework, I think that, it might just be helpful just to lift up a few of the most objectionable. So this comes from the K-3 book on gender identity, which is entitled Who Are You?, which introduces kids to the gender spectrum. And according to the lesson plan for the book, kids get to work the 3 layers of the gender wheel and learn how, quote, grown-ups might look at a baby's body when they're born and make a guess. This is the sex assigned at birth, male or female. But sometimes people get it confused with gender because gender is much more than the body you were born with. So that is the education, direct education for kindergartners related to what they have been told to this point, that you're a boy or you're a girl. And now the public schools are going to say, no, those people aren't right. So the framework then introduces high school students to the dangers of, quote, spiritual abuse, listed among other types of abuse, emotional, sexual, and physical. Teens are taught how to avoid report spiritual abuse, and examples of religious abuse include forcing other people to adhere to rigid gender roles and not allowing a partner to do things they enjoy. So you can see here that there is an effort to push an agenda. Maybe that's no surprise to anybody that we're talking here about a moral revolution. But I think that when we're talking about what is going to be taught at all levels in public school in the state of California, we're looking at the future of public education across the country. So the framework introduces high school students to a range of sexual terms that you and I would need a dictionary, including things like polysexual and pansexual. It encourages middle school teachers to invite abortion providers into the class as speakers. So again, remember, people who were gender nonconforming and transgender were encouraged to be brought into the classroom as early as pre-K and kindergarten to talk about gender. And here we've got abortion providers going to come talk to middle school students. So, quote, guest speakers from your local public health department, sexual health clinic, or local nonprofit organizations such as Planned Parenthood may have well-informed sexual health educators and age-appropriate materials to support comprehensive sex health education. So what they're saying to teachers is you don't have to learn all this. There's plenty of folks out there that are willing to come teach your students for you in these subject matter areas. So what's being pushed? I mean, maybe it's no surprise that we're talking here about the moral revolution, particularly related to human sexual behavior and what is called gender identity. And those who crafted California's proposed new framework for public schools, they know that you have to start young. So in a portion of the framework with students aged pre-K to third grade, gender is described as boy, girl, both, neither, trans, gender queer, non-binary, gender fluid, gender transgender, gender neutral, agender or agender, neutrous, I don't even know what that word means, bigender, third gender, two-spirit, and the list goes on and on. So if we look at the framework related to high school students, you know, I just think that it's important to recognize here that there is a extended conversation, not only about sexual orientation, but about these individuals' sexual practices. Why teachers would be talking about that, I have no idea. Teachers are reminded, quote, students may not conform to the social norms of binary gender identities of male and female. It's important to be sensitive and responsive to these students' needs. Be mindful of them. Identify gender pronouns, and be sure not to make assumptions based on appearance. There's actually a chart that appears at that point in time. So let me pause and consider one thing here. Whether or not you're a teacher, teachers, I think, are in the crosshairs here. Obviously, kids are in the crosshairs, and we recognize that, and parents need to be aware of this. But there's actually not a whole lot parents can do about it because you can't opt out. I think my real concern here is for teachers. What if you're a teacher operating out of an authentically Christian, biblically informed worldview? How are you going to be able in good conscience to continue teaching in the California public school system under this new framework? So while I'm concerned about kids and what they're going to be taught, I'm equally concerned about the entire public education apparatus in the state of California. Are they going to expel every person who's not going to conform to the moral revolution on this front and teach under this framework? So at one point in the draft, the text actually reads, some students may be non-monogamous, and the term partners may be used to be more inclusive. Now, why are we even having this conversation? Why is a student's romantic relational status relevant to the educational framework and what's going on at school? And no, there's no room in the conversation for ideas like abstinence. I already told you that only appears twice in 1,000 pages. Conversations about chastity, or whose religious convictions may run contrary to the ideas espoused by this dominant LGBTQIA machinery. So I want you to know this. There's no parental opt-out, because these portions of the curriculum are specifically categorized as sex education, or not categorized as sex education or HIV prevention education, which are the ones that are exclusionary under California law. So once this framework goes into effect, which, by the way, it's going to be adopted in May of 2019, that's the schedule, then curriculums will be written and parents will have no prior knowledge nor the opportunity to opt out of this instruction for their own children. Now, it seems pretty transparent to me that there's a moral revolution going on here. And we got to understand the importance of education of our children and the ways in which they are being taught and by whom and in what environments. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking with Justin Wells on how to film truth. It's a story of documentary filmmaking as a spiritual journey. It's also about the power of film and the power of media in education today. And so a great opportunity to link these two conversations together. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Joining me now for a conversation is Justin Wells. Justin is a documentary filmmaker, and he has a new book out exploring the ways in which filmmakers have sought to tell the truth in powerful and personal ways. The book is Filming Truth, Documenting Truth-Seeking, and Interacting with the World. Justin, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
It's a joy. It's a joy. So this is fun. We love the power of story. And so I would love for you to just begin by talking about what impact the telling of stories has on people.
So the book is How to Film Truth is the title of the book. And, you know, I started to think about this because I was going to the film, the Sundance Film Festival every year. And I started to really get into watching the documentaries and, you know, meeting the filmmakers and the directors and the subjects of these documentaries. And over the years, I started to notice that there was this sort of healing or transformative effect on behalf of the subjects in having someone make a film about them. You know, it gave them sort of a voice and, you know, someone interested in their life. And I noticed that, you know, you wonder sometimes whether or not a piece of media about someone is going to be exploitative and somehow doing harm to that person. But what I found over the years is actually the opposite, is that these people were coming out sort of better off, more self-aware, more solidarity amongst people that had seen their story and realizing that they're not alone in whatever struggles they might have and their circumstances. And it was a very healing activity. And then I started to notice also that the language that the filmmakers were using in terms of talking about this journey that they went on in learning about a story and then going out to document it, that they were describing this in terms of a spiritual journey. You know, so that's why I put the subtitle of the book, The Story of Documentary Film, as a spiritual journey. Because whether it was interesting, because whether or not these filmmakers were of a religious persuasion, they often talked in therapeutic language about the journey into learning about people's story, and so I started to think, you know what, this is a very powerful medium, and I started to look into how telling the truth can be a sort of a healing activity.
I love that, and I appreciate the truth-seeking nature of all of this. Again, friends, my conversation partner is Justin Wells. The book is How to Film Truth, The Story of Documentary Film as a Spiritual Journey. You can find Justin online at justinwellsfilms.com. So, Justin, let's talk about faith and how it is that your work in the film industry, because I think that people think about Hollywood, frankly, and they're having a hard time imagining, like, right, there's a believer out there. Well, there's lots of believers out there. And so talk with us a little bit about your experience in the film industry in relationship to your faith.
Yeah, you know, I've sort of been in the world of film and the world of faith and theology my whole career. You know, I went to Fuller Theological Seminary. I studied philosophy. I studied theology, religion and art, you know, but I've also been kind of in the art world and in the world of Hollywood and independent cinema. You know, I went to Art Center College of Design, and I've been working in Hollywood ever since undergrad. And, you know, what I noticed, and I think a lot of the time the nexus for this, you know, lining up of faith and film happens at these film festivals that I go to. And I'm a part of a group that does some dialogues. There's kind of interreligious and interfaith dialogues surrounding film, independent cinema at the Sundance Film Festival. And it's called the Windrider Forum. And we bring together students from a whole bunch of different universities and seminaries, and then we bring in filmmakers to have discussions about their films. And we found that more often than not, the questions that filmmakers and artists are interested in are very similar to the questions that religious people are tackling and wrestling with. So there's a lot of overlap in terms of the artistic enterprise and the faith enterprise. And so I find that the deeper you dig, I think there's a quote by a scholar of religion and film, Brent S. Plate. He says, dig around in art and you find religion, dig around in religion and you find art. You know, and that's what we've noticed is the more authentic you get as an artist, the closer to the sacred, the spiritual, the ineffable you're going to come.
So I find myself wondering lots of things while I'm talking with you. We had Aaron Wolf on to talk about a project that he's doing in relationship to these worship facilities. Like, right, he started with his own temple, the Wilshire Temple, there in, is that Hollywood? Wilshire Boulevard.
Could be, yeah.
And so I'm very interested. Like, this seems to be a really some soil that God seems to really be tilling, in terms of the way that faith stories inspire art, and the way that art really does have a way of bringing forward stories that are true in ways that deeply touch people's, you know, spiritual needs. So let's talk about art for a minute, if we can, because I don't think that art, and particularly beauty, is very well understood by Christians as something that is revelatory in terms of who God is.
Yeah, well, you're touching on my sort of life's message here, which is kind of has a dual purpose, and that's to get, you know, religious folks to be a little bit more open to beauty and art and the power of it, and also to get my more secular friends to be open to the spiritual in their work and in their art, you know. And I think because I'm constantly having conversations with both sides, I can sort of see this at work. We used to think, when we first started doing this Windwriter Forum at Sundance, we were partnering with the churches in Park City, and they thought that this Sundance Film Festival was sort of a cloud of darkness that they had to endure for 1 week a year and just sort of huddle inside their houses and wait for it to be over because of all of these sort of liberal, secular Hollywood folks that were descending on their town. You know, over the years, lots of the members of various churches in Park City have been attending our forum, and it's now a highlight of their year, you know, because there is always something going on in terms of the way the conversation develops. And it is almost something that you would think is a sort of providential subject that comes up that is very poignant, that people in the church ought to be talking about, and people in the culture are talking about. And so it becomes a very profound kind of experience for a lot of the religious people. And then the filmmakers are often very surprised, because the conversations that we have tend to deal with the content of their films, not just the marketability, you know, not just the money stuff, mm-hmm. not just the popularity, not just the star power, you know. And say, they often say, you know, your interviews are more refreshing for me as a filmmaker, me as an artist, because you actually want to know what I was thinking when I wrote that script. You actually want to know what I was thinking when we did that scene. You're not sort of trying to use me for popularity or, you know, for right. marketability or whatnot.
Hey, Justin, we got to take a quick break. Can you stick with me for another segment?
Yes, yeah.
Great. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm in the middle of a conversation with Justin Wells about his book, How to Film Truth, and we will be right back.
If I told you my story, you would hear hope.
Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing my conversation with Justin Wells about his book, How to Film Truth, The Story of Documentary Film as a Spiritual Journey. You can check out what Justin is doing at justinwellsfilms.com. Again, Justin, thank you so much for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about truth, because so much of what you're talking about in the book is this truth-seeking nature of documentary filmmaking. First of all, why does seeking the truth matter, and why does it make for really interesting documentaries? I mean, like, why are we drawn to that?
Yeah, you know, I started to think about this idea of truth, I think in a slightly different way than most people do. Most people think of truth in terms of facts, or verifiability, or journalistic categories. But I started to see that there was really something else going on in documentary film, And it has to do with ways in which we as a culture or we as a tribe or we as individuals tell the truth to each other. And so I call these, I call them truth-telling rituals, and they have very long and rich histories. You know, so you can think of confession as a literary genre, confession as a religious activity. You can think of testimony as a religious activity or as a something going on in the culture. Celebration, which is about remembering what's important. Lament, which is about not forgetting that which should never be repeated. And then maybe the poetic, this kind of poetic investigation into the miracle of existence. These are all forms of truth-telling that you can look at the history of, and you can sort of see how they work. You know, confession is about is really the basis for therapy, for psychoanalysis, and it's about self-knowledge versus self-deception. You know, testimony is about getting the truth out in terms of justice or in terms of encouragement for the tribe, you know. So I started this notice that you could take documentary films and you could almost see these as documentary film genres. You know, so confessional documentary is very personal, and it's about getting the truth. And people start to use the camera crazy. They start to say things to the camera that they wouldn't say to their friends or to their parents because of the presence of an empathetic listener. So I started to think, you know, I think filmmakers would be interested in knowing what they're tapping into. If you know more about confession and you know about the history of confession and what confession is and what confession does, you can make a more powerful confessional documentary, you know? So that's when I started to think of it in these ways. And then the more I looked, the more I started to explore celebratory documentary, for example, which is a great genre, the more I started to say, yeah, like, let me research what celebration is. Why do we celebrate things? You know, what's the history of it? And so I think it's actually a very new and interesting field of study that's good for the filmmaker or for audiences or film lovers.
Friends, my conversation partner is Justin Wells. We're talking about a range of things, but we are talking about his book, How to Film Truth, The Story of Documentary Film as a Spiritual Journey. And let me just assure Brooks Lally, who does listen to our show and is a film student out there at Loyola Marymount, I'm going to send you my copy so you don't have to harass me online for it. Because I really do think, Justin, like, right, this is... For young people who we know who are interested in film and they are interested in bringing their faith into that process, but frankly, they're not interested in making what they regard as cheesy Christian films. So what you're doing is you're frankly setting before us a theology of documentary filmmaking that also provides a way for people of faith to say, you know what, like, I get that. I get what he's talking about. And that's a place where I really do feel like I can connect in with this art world from which I feel tremendously disconnected on most days.
Yeah, and it's interesting because documentary, you're kind of constrained by reality. Like, in other words, you don't know what's going to happen. When you go in, if you're approaching filmmaking, one of my favorite filmmakers, Werner Herzog, calls it filmmaking as a journey on foot. You know, if you're approaching documentary film this way as a journey on foot, you don't know where it's going to lead. So you can't really. I think one of the reasons why people sometimes have a problem with I'm not sure what you call it, but the Christian film genre. Is that the,
well,
the, some, in, the,
sometimes it's just the, a little it's a little too predictable, and life is not.
That's what I'm. Yes, exactly. It feels like it's engineered, like the ending is sort of engineered on. You know, it's kind of a paint by numbers sort of a thing. Do this, and then this will happen. You know, when life is a lot more nuanced than that. You know, so I think that there's what I've seen over the years is that there's you have to approach it with an openness. And you often find things that happen that you did not expect. And what's interesting is that for secular folks that might have an ideology that they wouldn't want to be open to certain elements of the spiritual, or they may have characters that are religious and they're trying to understand what their motivation is – They often make a film that is very spiritual and very profound, even when they didn't mean to, because that's just what happened. You know, so in Sundance, sure. for example, they love dark, like depressing, anti-Hollywood films, you know, but the documentaries are often on about tough subjects, but they're often very uplifting and encouraging, you know. And I thought, well, how come they're allowed to have that at the Sundance Film Festival where the curators don't really want that? And I think the reason is because it actually happened, you know. So you often find, wow, this is a very inspiring story. This is a story of redemption. This is a story of grace, and it's here at the Sundance Film Festival. And you can't really say, well, it's not gritty enough or something, because, well, this is how it turned out, you know. So I think it's a very, very healthy way to explore the world. And, you know, if you're using your faith in that exploration, you can be open to whatever happens, and you can believe that it's important, it's true.
So, Justin, where does a person go to watch a documentary film with other people? Because I'm also feeling like I don't want to just watch this like all by myself. Like, I want there to be the opportunity for conversation and sort of the sense of a shared experience. And I like the experience of the reaction of other people. So where do people across the country go to watch documentary films?
Well, wow, that is something that I'm very passionate about, because I really think that there's kind of two worlds in Hollywood, and I'm not necessarily knocking this first one that I'm about to say, but it is less healing for the community, and that's celebrity culture. You know, celebrity culture is a false intimacy. You think you know that person, that celebrity. You're familiar with their face. You're familiar with their voice, but you don't really know them, you know? So it's not really a communal activity to have an award show where all the most beautiful people in the world gather and give themselves awards. You know, I was always, when I used to adjunct teach at a college, I always wanted to have a film festival at the end of the semester and invite the community to watch your work and discuss the content of your work, instead of having a quasi, you know, your version of the Academy Awards and dress up and give awards to each other. You know, I mean, of course, you could probably do both, I think. But if you were to choose, I would choose the film festival, because I think that's a better way to do it. Now, the only way to really do it is to just have screenings in your community. You know, I really want to take the art of documentary, the art of film, off of the pedestal of Hollywood and give it back to the people. And I think it's possible today more than ever because of the availability of the technology. Really, anyone can make a documentary film. And I put exercises at the back of my book, sort of, if you wanted to try your hand at making a confessional doc, a 5-minute, you know, documentary, we'll put a place up at the Real Spirituality Institute website to house those films if you want to send them in to us, you know. But really, the best way to do it is to just organize your community. In most cities, in Los Angeles where I'm at, there are a lot of screenings followed by discussion, you know, that are put on by the town, by the city of Pasadena does them. Real Spirituality Institute does them. You know, we do a lot of screenings. And then if there's a film festival in your town, I cannot recommend. Film festival culture to me is the heart of really what filmmaking is about, the art of film.
Okay, so I just Googled documentary film screenings near me, and guess what? There are some. And so it doesn't really matter, because I live in the dead smack middle of America. And so it apparently doesn't matter if you live in L.A. or you don't live in L.A. There are communities all over the place hosting documentary film events and then having these screenings. And there is a film festival coming up not too far in the future that's near me as well. So how fun is that? Like, I've learned something about my own community today. So, friends, my conversation partner is Justin Wells. You can check him out and what he's doing at justinwellsfilms.com. The book we're discussing today is How to Film Truth, The Story of Documentary Film as a Spiritual Journey. You mentioned that there's exercises in the back. So one of the things that I appreciate about any book that actually provides me with something to do is that it gives me a way of sort of enacting what I've read. So introduce people to some of these exercises in the back.
Yeah, well, I think that the one thing that is most interesting about any filmmaker or any artist, so if someone is aspiring to join the circus as I have, you know, join the film industry, what's the best thing that you have to offer is your own unique personality and story, because no one else is like you, you know. And I have an exercise back there that I call creative identity, which was actually an exercise that we did in art school, which is trying to find that one question, that really, really burning question that you have about life, about the world, about reality, that you want to explore. And most of the good filmmakers out there, Martin Scorsese, if you watch Martin Scorsese films, he's always at this one question. You know, what's up with human depravity? That if he strays away from that question, his films aren't as good, not as profound, you know? So I just kind of have a way, an exercise of listing all of the movies that you love and looking at how are they similar? How do they line up? And what is the question about reality that these films are trying to tackle? That might be a key to your own creative identity. You know, in art school, we were using it as a kind of way to market yourself, you know, but I saw that as something deeper. I saw it as, you know what, I think that we all want to go deep and we want to explore the hard questions. And that's really what art is about in many ways. And I feel like you can speed up the process of self-discovery with that exercise. And then, as I said, the other ones are, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You can tell people. I love it.
No, the other ones are just, you know, here's how you would approach making a confessional film. Here's, you know, my spiritual genres for documentary. Here's how you might approach making a testimonial film. Here's how you might approach making a lament film, you know. And then, you know, I'm just excited because now it's just starting to get out into film schools and stuff. I'm excited to see what people come up with when they approach it that way. You know, when they say, I'm going to make a lament film right now, you know, what is going to, you know, what is that going to look like? So I'm excited to see.
So I want to say to people who are listening, if you're thinking to yourself, you know what, I'm never going to become a documentary filmmaker, this isn't really in my wheelhouse, I want you to actually consider making a documentary about a person who you know and love, who is further along the spiritual journey, and maybe even, you know, just a step away from... I wish that someone had just sat down and recorded... you know, the spiritual testimony, the conversation, something with my grandmother before she died. And so get out there, people. You've got iPhones. If that's all you've got, that's what you've got. And you can actually make a documentary film about the saints, the living saints who you know in your own community or in your own church. Justin, we're going to have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for being with us here today on Connecting Faith.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
All right, friends, this is Carmen LaBurge, and I'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Justin Wells about how to film faith, the story of documentary film as a spiritual journey. It's a good opportunity to talk about the power of media in the way that we learn things and the way that we understand the truth about things. So let me ask this question, returning to or sort of circling back around to where we started this hour, the conversation about education. What are all of the inputs of education for your kids today? And when I say your kids, I'm really talking about all of our kids. Like, are we still teaching the Bible the way that we learned it when we were little? And is that still effective? Not just in terms of, you know, what we might call the banking theory of education. You know, not are we just sure that kids are memorizing passages of Scripture, it's important, but are we actually teaching them to think critically and to operate out of a functional biblical worldview as they live in an environment of competing worldviews today? I think that's a huge question. I think it's an important question. We've got new numbers from Lifeway about the percentages of our kids that actually, you know, leave the faith once they graduate from high school. And we know that that is a challenge for us. We certainly know that the percentage of young people in the culture who are who now describe themselves as being nuns, people who are affiliated with no particular faith group or religion. We know that that is on the rise. And so what are we not doing? What are we failing to do that would actually help us keep our own? I mean, maybe that's one way to say it. You know, we have this wonderful process of natural evangelism where Christians have children, right? We have babies. But if we don't raise them effectively in the faith, then it's not as if we're raising the next generation of Christians. And so you might have lots of teenagers in your church, and you might be celebrating that. But here's what the Lifeway research is telling us. And again, I'm just reading from this brand new survey that they just posted. So it's at lifewayresearch.com. And the title is this: Did you stop attending church regularly, twice a month or more, for at least a year between the ages of 18 and 22? You should see the spike on the graph. So I'll read the lead. Church pews may be full of teenagers, but a new study says college students might be a much rarer sight on Sunday mornings. So two-thirds, or 66% of American young adults who attended a Protestant church regularly for at least a year as a teenager, say they dropped out for at least a year after they turned 18. So in those early adult years of 18 to 22, they dropped out for at least a year. So 34% say they continued to attend twice a month or more. So we've got 34%, just barely over one-third, of students who are in church in high school who are in church in college. I mean, that's just sort of the simple math here. One-third of the students in our churches in high school actually choose to participate actively in the life of a local church when they are in college. And you may say to yourself, ah, well, they'll come back. That used to be true. That's not proving itself out anymore. So I think that we have to be rethinking or thinking differently about the way we help young people answer the questions that they have, the real questions that they have. So ask yourself, in the Sunday school classes at your church, are children encouraged to ask whatever questions that they have, whatever questions they have, and whatever questions their peers are asking? Is there an opportunity for children to actually ask their questions and have their real questions answered? I taught fifth grade Sunday school a couple of years back with my husband. And we obviously had a curriculum that we were teaching, a curriculum that was chosen, you know, by the leadership of the church, assigned to us to teach. It became very evident to us very early on that the kids in our class were way beyond the curriculum that we were supposed to be using. So these were kids who had been, you know, like literally born and raised in the church. And so there were, you know, there were visitors who obviously for whom it was completely new information. But in terms of the active engagement of the fifth graders in our class who were there consistently week in and week out, it was very apparent that what they really wanted to do was ask their honest questions and get honest answers. And sometimes we didn't, right off the top of our heads, know the answers to their questions. But we were committed to going and finding the answers to their questions or helping them find the answers to their own questions, which is also, by the way, a great way to go about it. So what kinds of questions do fifth graders asking? Well, fifth graders are actually asking pretty big questions, questions that aren't covered in most fifth grade Bible curriculum. They're asking worldview questions. They're asking questions about the veracity of the Bible. How do I know that it's true? How do I know that the Bible is true and the book that my Muslim friend uses is not true? How do I, you know, we talk about being evangelical and we talk about the Great Commission and we talk about needing to share Jesus with other people. But are we really sure there is a hell? And how are we really sure who's going there? Because it seems like a really mean thing to say to my friend, you know, who thinks that their ideas are just fine. How do I know that their ideas aren't just fine? Why are the claims of Christianity exclusive? Why is that a necessary part of understanding who Christ is understanding that he's the only way to salvation? What is salvation and why do we need it? What kind of God requires a blood sacrifice? Like, that seems crazy. These are the kinds of questions, by the way, that fifth graders ask. fifth graders want to know rational, reasonable, verifiable answers to their questions. Yes, they want to know what the Bible says about certain things, but they also want to know answers to their questions about many things. So where are they going to find those? So it's one thing to teach kids the Bible. It's another thing to equip them to actually think critically and prepare to engage the competing worldviews that they encounter in the world every day. Our kids inhabit a different world than the one that we grew up in. And this is the most diverse. We've talked about this before on Connecting Faith. This is the emerging generation is the most diverse generation in all of American history. And they need equipment. They need equipping to understand how to engage with other kids who are from different faith backgrounds or from no faith background at all. They live in a climate of pluralism at best, and they live in a climate that is antagonistic toward Christianity at worst. What is truth, and how do we know it? How do we speak it, and how do we defend it? Is the Bible reliable? What does that mean? Why do bad things happen? And when bad things happen, how do we respond to that? How do we accept that? So we have to help our kids understand the gospel not only as the Roman road and the way to salvation, but as the cosmology, as the operating system in which we are all living. We have to help them understand the creation, fall, redemption, glory narrative, its eternal scope and its temporal relevance. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means we have to actually equip our kids as apologists. Studying the Bible is wonderful and teaching them the scriptures is wonderful. But they also have to know how to critically think. And they have to know how to take what they know from the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments and not only apply them in their own lives, but bring them to bear in the conversations that they are having every single day with others. So let me offer up today a couple of websites that you might want to check out if this is in your wheelhouse and you're nodding your head up and down and you're saying to yourself, I need some help with that. There are a couple of curriculums that are specifically designed for that kindergarten through elementary age crowd. One of them is called Foundation Worldview. You can find it at foundationworldview.com. And another one is Deep Roots Bible, and you can find that at deeprootsbible.com. They are different somewhat in their approach, but I think that they are equally valid in terms of their pedagogy. They're both based online, so it's not like you're going to buy a bulk of stuff. They're designed for homeschoolers. They're designed for Sunday school classrooms. They're designed for one-on-one. They're designed for groups. They're designed for classes. It's scalable. It's something that you as an individual can do. You could do it at your school. You could do it at your church. You could do it in your small group. I mean, on and on and on. So foundationworldview.com or deeprootsbible.com. Again, they're different. Check them both out. See what you think. If you are talking about high school students, I would direct you to Summit Ministries and Impact 360. And if you're looking for college resources, I would send you to Rocio Christi, Reasons to Believe, Every Campus, Moms in Prayer International College Ministry, and Campus Link. All right, friends, tomorrow on Connecting Faith, I'll be talking with international worship leader and recording artist Darlene Check about her book, The Golden Thread, Experiencing God's Presence in Every Season of Life, and Tricia Scribner about her book, Life Givers, Apologetics, Women Designed and Equipped to Share Reasons for the Hope Within. Both of these women love the Lord and help us see, appreciate, and live into our calling as Christ ambassadors wherever we find ourselves at every stage of life. So that's tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Hey, it's been great to be with you today. Check out what we're doing at MyFaithRadio.com. Connecting Faith has a page. You can always email me, Carmen@MyFaithRadio.com. Have a great weekend, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this episode of Connecting Faith. These conversations are available because of listener support. Thanks for making a gift now at MyFaithRadio.com. To catch future editions of Connecting Faith, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to connect the eternal with the everyday through Connecting Faith.